This is an RTRFM podcast. RTRFM is a community organisation and relies on volunteer and listener support. To learn more about what we do, visit rtrfm.com.au.
So we're sailing along and there's this cacophony, honking horn, people screaming. I can actually hear human beings. You could never do that. Yeah. So I dropped back to my position and said to Richo, the other grinder, "Hey, Richo, I think we're going to win the America's Cup."
Oh, no.
And the whole crew heard me, and they all came down on me like a ton of bricks. "Shut up, chick, we haven't won yet." To which I responded, "Don't jinx it." I said, "Well, you know, I think we could push it over from here." Anyway, and across the line we went.
Off the coast of Rhode Island at 5:21 p.m. on the 26th of September 1983, Australia 2 crossed the finish line to win the America's Cup.
It was a really big deal because the US has held that cup over 132 years.
I mean, the race itself started about 3:30 in the morning our time, and so we all got up bleary-eyed and watched it.
What I do remember quite clearly is waking up to the sound of car horns.
We were even contemplating not going to school. Bob Hawke said if any boss who sacks, you know, their employees is a bum, and we thought the same applied to going to school.
The sense of victory was edible. It was so huge. It rippled through you.
We were aware that Australia had come back from 3-1 down, I think it was, but you know, had a sense of some real history being made.
Everyone that registered a new car or bought a new car that needed new plates, for about 2 or 3 years it said WA, home of the America's Cup.
Little old Perth had won the world over.
And I remember on the radio they were playing Men at Work, I Come From a Land Down Under, for weeks.
The first time I ever saw him, I said, "Oh, good morning, Mr. Bond." And he said to me, "Young fella," he said, "my friends call me Alan."
Yeah, it was pretty iconic.
It was a win that captivated the nation, breaking the United States' 132-year winning streak and evoking one of Australia's greatest quotes from the politician Bob Hawke.
"Any boss that sacks anyone today for not turning up is a bum."
"Any boss who sacks, you know, their employees is a bum."
"That any bloke and woman who was a boss was an absolute mug to, you know, punish their employees if their employees wanted to bludge." Now, isn't that Australian?
Perth is one of the most isolated cities in the world. So far removed from the rest of the globe, it might as well be its own planet. Join me, Jeff Bullen, as I take a deep dive into the weird, wacky, and unexplained history of our eccentric city, digging up memories of bygone icons, personalities, and events. This is Planet Perth. Australia too evokes so many memories for Perth locals, but we thought we'd track someone down that was right there amongst the action.
Well, I'm John Longley. I'm now a retired guy. I've been a sailor all my life. I basically was lucky enough to be involved in Trader 2's win in 1983.
It's been more than 40 years since that race. Does it feel like it's been that long?
No. Not at all. It was such a impactful time in my life that I can remember it all so clearly. And of course, when you can remember something very clearly, it tends to bring it close to you. So it doesn't. I mean, last year was our 40th anniversary, and it just was bizarre to all of us that there was still so much interest. And so many people came and said, "Wow, you know, it was a fantastic thing." No, it was amazing.
Well, I've got to admit, I took Hawkey's advice that day in WAG school, so.
John Longley is a veteran of Australia 2, involved in 5 campaigns for the America's Cup, including the 1983 victory. Like Australia, John and his team remember that time with fondness, including the yacht that sailed them to victory.
Our girl, you know, we loved it. Loved it dearly. But we...
she didn't have a pet name.
No, but we didn't. She didn't need a pet name. We just petted her. We just loved her so much. And she always looked fantastic.
His love for sailing runs deep. But for him, it's the thrill of the competition that ultimately took over.
I still get a buzz when I first go jump on a boat, go sailing, off the boat goes, and it's just fantastic, you know? I just love it. But it's also, when you start getting to that level, it's the competition.
Yep.
The actual being able to, A, trim your boat so it's going to its optimum, and then your wit against the wit of the skippers and the crews and the other boats, and your ability to look at the wind. And people who don't sail say, well, how can you do that? Well, of course you can. There are so many ways of looking at the wind, whether it's on the water or whether it's birds or whether it's trees or whatever, you can see wind. And it's this absolute game that you never get good at. it's really hard because the wind is always cleverer than you are.
The 1983 Australia 2 campaign was iconic. But as John explains, the history of the sport goes way, way back.
Well, yes, it is the oldest international sporting competition in the world. And a way of describing it in a way is it's almost like a fossil event because it doesn't fit any of the modern sporting competitions. There's no overreaching international body that controls it. It's mm-hmm. just this bizarre event that is based upon a 1.5-page document called the Dieter Gift. Right. So how did that come about? Well, 1851 was the Great Exhibition in London. The Brits were on top of the world. And they were about to show the world that they, in fact, were on top of the world. Yeah. So the whole exhibition, the Crystal Palace, all of that was all about that. The Americans, who were sort of still an upstart new country, comparatively, a couple of them were over in England and had noticed the huge fleet of British yachts sailing around and decided that, you know what, we don't think they're all that good. So what they did is, that because they were then invited to go to the Great Exhibition, to the regatta that was going to be held down as a part of that, down in Cowes, and a group of them out of the New Yacht Club got together and they commissioned a naval architect to design them a boat based upon the New York pilot boats, which they thought were much faster. And the reason that they were faster was a good old America. There was the jobs that were given to the pilot boats were based upon the fact that when the masts and sails of a ship coming in to New York Harbor came over the horizon, the pilots would leap into their pilot boats and race out to the boat. And the people who got there first got the gig. So they pretty quickly, you know, worked out how to go faster and faster. So they designed a boat called the America, which was a big schooner, based upon those New York pilot boats. They sailed it across the Atlantic to England, went to France, got rid of the sort of delivery sails, if you like, and got the boat ready to race, sailed across to the Isle of Wight, which is you know, Cowes is on the north point of the Isle of Wight. And there's a strip of water called the Solent, goes up from the famous Needles up to the, because it's sort of like a diamond-shaped island. America arrived there, and the tide was against it, so it anchored for a while. And the word got out back to Cowes that this American boat had arrived, and so a couple of them went down, a couple of the British boats went down to sort of welcome it here, and they pulled up alongside just as the tide changed and wind came in, and the American skipper made a terrible mistake. He, instead of sandbagging and just sort of limping up the Needles, he pulled the sails on and blitzed them. Now, that completely ruined their summer because they weren't there to win a yacht race. They were there to win money. The whole thing was about wagering. So that they would, what they wanted to do was to get there and put wagers on with other rich owners of these incredible boats and make a killing. So they sat at anchor in Cowes for most of the summer. Nothing happened. No one would take them on because of this one.
They blew it.
They blew it, totally blew it. And then in Cowes Week, which is sort of like in the middle of summer, the Queen Victoria put up a trophy for a race around the Isle of Wight called the 100 Guinea Cup. And it was for all whoever wanted to enter. And so the Americans said, well, can we enter? And the British said, no. It was only for British boats. And then it was the press that then got stuck into the Royal Yacht Squadron and bullied them into basically allowing the American boat to enter. And the way they started was that they all started at anchor, and then the gun was fired. You pulled up your anchor and off you went. Well, the poor old America fouled her anchor. She was the last off the line, and away she went. And of course, there was no radio or any other way of working out what was going on. So Queen Victoria later on went out to find naval ship that was off the off Cowes to see the fleet returning after circumnavigating the island. And the first yacht came into sight, and she turned to her to an ensign next door and said, "And what yacht is that?" And he said, "It is the America, Your Majesty." And she said, "Ah, well, and who's coming second?" And there was a pause, and he said, "There is no second, Your Majesty." And so the America won that race. In actual fact, they all caught up a bit because the tide got against them. But they won it by only 8 minutes, but they won it. And they weren't the biggest boat. They were sort of, you know, mid-sized boat. So they won this silver ewer, and they took it back to America, put it on the mantelpiece in the yacht club and looked at it. And then after a while thought, well, what are we going to do with this? And there was a syndicate of people who had owned America, and so they thought, well, maybe we'll just melt it down and make some medals, and we can all have a medal. And that was sort of thought about for a while. They thought, no, let's not do that. They said, no, what we'll do, we'll put it up as a challenge cup. So if anybody wants to challenge us to win it, then they can do so. And so they wrote a deed of gift, a page and a half long, which basically said, look, we've got this cup. If you're from a bona fide yacht club and you've got a boat that's at least this big, they defined the size, then you can challenge us for it. And there'll be three races, and you know, the first race will be a triangle, the next race will be up and down, the next one will be a triangle, and that's it. So that was sort of set up. But unfortunately, the Civil War came along, so nothing happened for about another 20, 30 years. It wasn't until 1887, from memory, that the first challenge happened. And it sort of took off. And there was challenge after challenger, mainly from Britain. There was a couple from Ireland, of course, with Thomas Lipton, Sir Thomas Lipton, who challenged five times. The couple from Canada, and they were complete disasters. The boats were just wrecks. anyway, so finally it went right through until the Second World War. And then after the Second World War, with all the austerity after the war, the whole thing really sort of didn't get going again. So the New York Club said, well, what are we going to do to get it going? They said, well, we've got to make the boat smaller. So, and we need to work out a type of boat. So they chose the 12-meter class, which were boats about 65 feet long, weighed about 25 tons, and had been designed as a class in 1907. So they got the first one going again in 1956, and then every 3 years they would accept challenges. Australia first got involved with Sir Frank Packer in 1962 with Gretel. He challenged again. There was another Australian challenger in 67, Dame Patty. Then 1970, challenged again with Gretel too, and won a race.
Big deal?
Well, yeah, it was a big deal because they're best of seven. And the Americans just usually nearly always won 4-0. And so that's when Alan Bond got involved. He actually bought the two Gretels off Sir Frank Packer. And of all places, he shipped them to Yanship Sun City. And that's sort of when I got involved, because I started sailing with Alan in Cowes in 1971. And obviously I did fairly well with him on his Apollo. And he offered me a job coming to start doing all of this. And I'll never forget returning from England, where I'd been sailing in the sort of the British scene over there. And suddenly I find myself in Yanship Sun City. And it's still a fairly remote place. It's still the end of Perth, you know. Yeah. But in those days, my God.
There was no freeway those days.
Oh, God, no. And it was a... and it was just a sandy wasteland with this marina that Alan built, and these 212 meters sitting on moorings out in the middle, because there were no jetties at that stage or whatever. And we used to go and race off Yanship, and train, if you like, off Yanship, and it was a nightmare because it blows pretty hard.
Yes.
And these boats were not designed for 25-30 knot sea breezes, and big waves and so forth. But that led it to his first challenger, which was Southern Cross in 1974. And then the game had changed a bit in 1970, where the Americans allowed more than just one challenger, and then you had to have a series of races that play off. Yeah, the Americans, one of the reasons they always used to win, other than that they controlled the rules, was that they would have three or four boats competing to become the defender.
Uh-huh.
And so they were really sorted out, both from a design point of view, but also from their crew techniques and all of that. And the best boat came through. And then the poor old challenger, who'd just been sailing around on his own, and came up against a battle-hardened team and got whacked. You know? So then, of course, we went through the Bond Challengers, 74, 77, 80, and then finally 83 when we won it. And I was involved in all of them, and in fact in the defence here in 87.
A big part of the Australia 2 story was the construction of the yacht itself. The Australia 2 was owned and built by a syndicate of West Aussies, notably the tycoon Alan Bond. It was constructed in Cottesloe by local boat builder Steve Ward and designed by the ingenious Ben Lexon, the brains behind the yacht's infamous secret weapon.
So she was a fantastic weapon all over. The keel, in a way, was as much a psychological weapon as it was a real weapon. Hydrodynamically, the boat was really good, but also it gave enormous range. Because stability is not measured in the 12-metre rule.
Right.
Yeah. And because the keel was upside down, it meant it was really competitive when it blew hard, even though the hull was small. And then the other thing that we never figured out in the tank, wasn't until we actually built the boat, was that the boat, because the span of the keel was so short, where it joined onto the canoe body of the hull, it meant that the boat turned incredibly well. So she tacked incredibly well. As a one-on-one fighting machine, she could turn inside at the start. So she was a fantastic weapon all over. Knowing that we might have an advantage here, because the tank said we were just going to blitz it.
Yeah.
The tank was wrong, by the way, because we were only a little bit, we were good.
Yeah.
But the tank results didn't really take into an impact of waves. And the waves and the wings didn't get on very well, as we had to find it. But it certainly was a really good boat, and hydrodynamically the boat was good and a bit better than in a conventional boat. But what we then did is we said, look, let's make sure that we cover every base. So we've got to go for it in everything. So the masts that we used were actually American masts built out of 7,000 series aluminium. The Americans didn't want to use them because they said that's not a marine grade alloy and they'll fizz and, corrode before the summer's over. We said we'll take that punt, but we know that 7,000 series is going to have better bend characteristics than a 6,000 series.
Did you snap a mast?
Never one of them. No, not an Australia 2 never broke a mast. And so there was this combination of the sails being light, the rigging being light, the light 7,000 series aluminium masts.
Now you're starting to get a lot of technological.
Plus the keel. Plus, this was our fourth go. And we'd had enough of getting beat. We highly respected all of the other challengers. We were confident we could beat them. The main challenger that we had to knock off was the British. The victory, they had a huge campaign. They had built three boats, two of them had in Newport. They had they had a huge budget. They were a big deal. And so to beat them was our main game. The other boat, then of course also the other Australian boats, because there were two other Australian boats there, Advance out of Sydney and Challenge 12, which was also designed and built by us for a Victorian syndicate. And there was very much a sort of a West Australian, Victorian AFL competition between us two, so we did not like getting beaten by the Victorians.
The America's Cup committee had a little bit of a say about it. There was secret meetings behind closed doors. What was going on?
The first thing that they decided was, because they knew the boat had wings, they said this is an illegal boat because the rule says that if you have an aberration, if you like, an unusual thing, the measurers can decide that it could be ruled out.
Yeah.
And they said wings are unusual. Whatever. And the measurer said, no, the keel can be any shape it needs to be, right? Then they said, when the boat tips over, because the wing sticks out, the leeward wing will go below a draft of 12 feet, which is all the rule allows, and therefore it's illegal. And the measurer said no, because the rule is very, very clear that you measure the draft when the boat is on the land and vertical.
Ah, okay.
And so, whatever. So they were getting nowhere with that. So they then sent over a secret delegation, if you like, to the NSMB and said, we want you to design a boat for us like you designed one for the Australians. And the NSMB said, no, we didn't. Ben Lexon designed the boat. We provided the facility, and obviously our technical people would talk to Benny and so forth, but no, Ben Lexon's the designer. So they then attacked our challenge on the basis that we were illegal because the boat had been designed by the Dutch, which is right. Clearly ironical, because their boat was designed by a Dutchman, Johan Valentine, who just happened to have an American passport. So all summer long, right, closer and closer we got to the match, this attack came upon us until finally they gave in. So then it was only just before the actual America's Cup race where the Americans said, all right, well, we're just going to race you on the water.
Did you ever feel at any stage that that Australia wasn't going to be able to race?
No, because we knew that we hadn't done anything wrong. We were fine. Then Benny Lexon, the designer, he came to Alan and said, Alan, so the only way we're going to beat them over here, because it's so hard, is if we can get a technical breakthrough. So what I want to do is I want to go to this incredible facility in Holland called the NSMB, the Nederlands Ship Model Basin. It's an incredible facility with lots of very clever people. But the big advantage of it was that you could test tank models that, instead of being 4 or 5 feet long like most of our models and our testing before, they could be 1/3 scale. So they were 22 foot long, the models.
Right, yeah.
So that, and of course, the bigger the model, the more accurate is the results you get back.
It's how it's reacting to a water molecule, so that size doesn't change.
There's a thing called the Reynolds number, which basically how you scale up a result from a model, because the viscosity of the water is out of whack with the size of the boat. Yeah. It's like sailing the boat in treacle if you're only using a small model. It gets complicated, but you know what I mean. So we were using Benny was using these 22-foot models, and he designed a conventional 12-metre, very based off the work that he'd done on Australia before, and he was getting really frustrated because he could just get tiny little improvements, nothing that was going to be a breakthrough. And they then developed this idea that, why don't we put the keel the other way up? And we said, well, that doesn't work because that means that the big span, because it's a roughly triangular shape, is at the bottom and you lose pressure underneath. So that ain't going to work, even though it's going to make the boat very stable. They said, well, maybe we could put wings on the bottom to control the loss of pressure. And Benny said, look, I've tried that with, with boats before, and it just creates too much drag. But there was a facility in Holland down the road called the Delft Institute, and they had been doing a lot of work on wings for aeroplanes.
Right.
So Benny went down there and started working with these guys, and they converted the computer programs and so forth that they had developed for aeroplanes to work for wings. And they came up with this concept that maybe it did work. And then Benny, well, that was for aeroplanes. And then sort of Benny ooched it into a sort of a hydrodynamic situation.
Yeah.
And that was all his background on dolphins and watching birds fly, because he was such an organic designer.
Uh-huh.
And out of all this came this little 12-meter. She was minimum. Her keel was upside down. The wings were actually lead as well.
Planet Perth.
WA's unique Kumbarung Festival, Evernow, is returning to Borloo, Perth. Enjoy three incredible free events from October 3rd to 7th. See King's Park light up for Bornawungan, The Trees Speak, or visit Song Circle, which finds a new home along the Derwal Yerrigan at Burswood Park. Plan your visit at evernow.com.au. Evernow supports Planet Perth and RTR FM.
Planet Perth.
The last time I came here was like for a school excursion in year three or something.
Yeah, I came down here like with my nieces visiting her from Adelaide.
Yeah, cute. It's pretty pretty impressive. Is this it?
Yeah, huh?
That's it. That's her.
The design and construction of the yacht by Lexham was so central to the Australia 2 story that producer Danny and I had to go and spend some time with the beautiful boat ourselves. Luckily, it's on full display at the Maritime Museum in Fremantle. The museum itself was purpose-built to house this West Australian icon.
Oh, it was in Time magazine.
Shit.
There was also some excellent paraphernalia on display.
Prime Minister Bob Hawke joined supporters at Royal Perth Yacht Club to watch the finish of the seventh race. He greeted the victory in true larrikin style, saying, go on, Jeff.
Any boss who sacks anyone for not turning up today is a bum.
Classic.
Knowing John's role as a port grinder, we had to give the simulation a go ourselves. Without much luck.
Individual.
I don't know how I'm going to go with this here.
Okay.
You can be on.
Here we go. Oh, no, you've got to use both hands. But yep, there we go.
It's light at the moment.
And how does that feel? How long do you reckon you could keep going like doing that?
I reckon I could go for a while. It's pretty light.
You could churn out a minute?
Yeah, I reckon. Oh,
that's moderate.
That's only moderate. Whoa, I'm puffing. See how you go. So light is very light.
Yeah, light's light. I know that hurts.
That's moderate. Not bad, not bad, moderate.
And we're having to use like stomach muscles to do that one already.
Yep. Whoa, go Jeff.
That's some hard yakka. Think I'll be sticking to my day job. Trying the tiller out for ourselves made us realise how hard the team would have worked to win the penultimate race. But what an incredible and defining moment it was.
Australia at that time was going through a recession, there was high unemployment, the economy was in trouble, we had a bit of a chip on our shoulder as a nation, things weren't going well. And there's a lovely analogy of what happened with the Matildas last year. Just imagine if the Matildas had gone on and won.
Mm, yeah.
Now, everyone in this country was starting to become an expert on women's soccer, even if they'd never seen a soccer game in their life, never kicked a soccer ball, right? Well, that happened in Australia at that time. Everyone became an expert on sailing. So when we towed out, yes, that day we were confident. And I did the bow. So I did the bow at the start, which is silly for someone who's 6'5" to be doing the bow.
Explain doing the bow.
Oh, well, basically at the start, you put someone right on the bow, mm-hmm. and that is to call the overlaps, to call the line in particular. So as the boat comes up to the line, it's whether the bow goes across, not the back of the boat.
Yeah.
So you put an experienced man on the bow to do all of that. And I looked across just as the 10-minute gun had gone, because it was a 10-minute pre-start, and I looked at this jib that the Americans had. I said, what the heck is this? We didn't figure out what was going on. It was just a weird-looking jib they had up, and off we went, and they were faster. So they were faster than us on the first beat. Even though we got in front, they got past us again. On the two reaches, nothing much happened because it was just spinnakers. The jib didn't,
come into it too much.
Next beat, we slipped further behind, and halfway up that beat, I said to Brian Richardson, who was the other grinder, I said, gee, Richo, this is not looking good, mate. I reckon he's 2 minutes in front of us. And then we tacked off. And as we went off further out to the left, we got headed, which was good, more breeze. And when we tacked, it was a lift. When we came back to the top mark, we were only 57 seconds behind. So we'd halved the lead. And then Dennis put up his spinnaker, jibed to go to the it's the right upwind. We always go to the right, in other words, because it's always the same way. So he jibed to go to the right. We kept going. Phil Smidmore, our mast man, said, hey, John, keep going. There's some pressure out here, wind out here. We got out there into a bit better pressure and started wiggling down at him. When finally they came back together, we were sort of bow on bow. We were locked together. He jibed onto us, and then the two boats sailing side by side, maybe only 50 metres apart, and we were sailing a little bit lower, which was getting us closer to the mark. It was an amazing situation. It was a fantastic race. If we'd just gone out there and blitzed them, I don't think anybody would have really wouldn't have become such a famous
race.
But
it had it all, didn't it? I mean, the close finish next to the spectators.
Absolutely.
For everyone to see. It just, yeah. Well, should you take us back to there? Tell us about the aftermath of it all. I mean, you guys were sporting heroes internationally. I mean, you took part in parades. What was it like on the streets of Perth?
Well, it was bizarre because
I mean, they had a parade for you here.
Yeah, I'll get to that. Well, when we won, we never realised what was going back in Australia, because part of our own psychology dealing with the pressure was to ignore it.
Mm.
So we played these mind games, like the spectator fleet wasn't a spectator fleet. It was a fishing competition, nothing to do with us.
Right.
The hundreds of balloons, helicopters, fixed-wing aeroplane flying above us, was nothing to do with us. That was just an air show. We never read any of the press. Why would you? It always amazes me that AFL footballers read the press. Yeah. Why would you? Don't do it, boys. You know what's going on. Why bother listening to some guy outside your team telling you what's going on? You know what's going on.
Well, even more random commenters on social media, really. It's like everybody has an opinion, people.
Don't go there. So the end result of all of that was we had really no idea what was going on in Australia because we switched off.
Yep.
And suddenly we won and we lift our heads up, and Skippy Lisserman, who was the port trimmer, he rang his mum. And remember those days it was really expensive to ring.
Bloody oath it was.
So he rang his mum. He hadn't spoken to her for 5 months, too expensive, and said, hey, mum, we won the America's Cup. And she said, I know. And he said, how do you know that?
So the fact that it was like Bob Hawke saying your boss is a bum if he sacks you for going to work.
So, and then the crew, I didn't go. I had to stay in America to do some stuff for Alan. But the crew flew back with Qantas, and Qantas had painted the tail, the tape painted off the red tail and put the boxing kangaroo on it. You know, it was just extraordinary stuff.
That's next level.
But before we left Newport, a telex, do you remember them, came through from the West Australian government saying, we are going to do a parade for you when you get back from Fremantle to Perth. And I spoke to Warren Jones. I said, that's ridiculous. Don't they realise it's 12 miles or, you know, there may be some people in Fremantle, and what are we going to be doing? Sitting in open cars, driving down with two people and a dog watching us? That's not going to be, no, we're not going to do that. Of course, it happened. We arrived and Fremantle was bursting at the seams. We all got in open cars and drove down the Stirling Highway. They were four deep the whole way. When we got to the Esplanade in front of Perth, police numbers, there were 250,000 people there. The population of Perth then was a million. Mm. So one in four people were there. It was just extraordinary.
It was a big deal.
And we weren't professional athletes. You know, we weren't used to this. We were paid $10 a day. You know, we were amateurs, Corinthians, whatever you want to call us. We got two pairs of shorts and four T-shirts to sail in.
Wow.
So, it's not as if we had grown up through in a professional sport, even like the Olympics is today. We were teachers and sailmakers and boat builders and lawyers and so forth. So it was a bizarre experience for all of us, I can tell you.
Wow. That little bit surprises me there. I mean, you see it being such a sport of the wealthy, you know, from Alan Bond through to the, I think, you know, with the Aga Khan observing. I just had always assumed that,
But, you know, sailing is still like that. People outside the sport still think it's a sport that rich people play. Yeah, people who own the boats tend to be well-heeled. But all the kids who sail on them, they're just kids. And they can come from, and of course, the yacht clubs now are so much more open to not they ever close, but they are embracing and bringing people from all walks of life in. And so it's actually not a elite sport at all. It's a sport of the people.
John says the race really did define the nation and charted a new course for the America's Cup event.
Well, it broke the mold.
Yeah.
And 132 years of history went out the door. We then sort of followed the history with the defence, which I've alluded to earlier. So our crew, Damien was a carpenter. The major was ex-army.
Yep.
The masked man was a boat builder. So on it goes down the line of the boat. We're just very ordinary people who loved sailing and ended up being lucky to be in the right spot to get on that crew.
Well, and love sailing, and it's very obvious when you're talking about it that there was a great deal of love for the boat. It wasn't just a tool.
Yeah, and we were also very lucky in that. We do to this day. We're a band of brothers. We love each other. We really do.
With a group that large as well, of 37 odd people, that's a lot of people to have together and not have fireworks.
And that comes back not only from the people but also from the leaders.
Yeah,
it's I've only recently been watching that program, Ted Lasso, and I just see so many things that are common. The event has always morphed into the absolute top end of the technology. It has to, otherwise it would become a sideshow in sailing.
Yeah. John Longley, thank you so much for joining us on Planet Perth. It's been an absolute hoot having a conversation with you today.
Yeah, it's been great fun, thanks.
Oh, mate, we could go on for hours. A big thank you to John Longley for joining us on Planet Perth. My name is Jeff Bullen, and I'm your host. Thanks to our assistant producer, Siobhan Dale, and executive producer, Danielle Raphael, who also edits this podcast. Our theme music is Can't Blame the City by local band The Mackerels, with artwork by Hannah Coakley. If you'd like to get in touch with an interesting story for us to cover, you can reach us at talks@rtrfm.com.au. Next time on Planet Perth, we're sitting down with historian and aficionado of dodgy pubs, Eddie Marcus, to chat about the Brisbane hotel shooting.
Thank you for listening to this RTRFM podcast. RTRFM is a community organisation and relies on volunteer and listener support. Visit rtrfm.com.au for more podcasts and other great content, as well as details on how you can support the station. You can also download our app and access RTRFM anytime and anywhere on your mobile device.